I'm back again, and this time I sat down with British ultra-running sensation Beth Pascal to talk paediatrics, what makes a good coach, ultra-running, and her record-breaking Bob Graham round, with a few other things sprinkled in between. Hope you enjoy it. Here we go. Welcome, Beth. Thank you for joining me on the pod. I'm sure a lot of people probably wanting to hear about your recent record-breaking Bob Graham round. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But first, I thought we might step back a little bit and dive maybe a tad deeper into sort of what you do to maybe understand you a little bit better. I'm certainly quite interested to understand and get to know you a little bit more and where these kind of performances come from. So I'm right saying you're a doctor.
Yes. Yeah.
And you work in paediatrics, is it?
Yes, paediatrics.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which I imagine sort of a combination of it, both incredibly rewarding and also probably at times desperately sad. I mean, is that sort of the case, or like what led you into paediatrics?
I think more the former, as in most of the time in paediatrics, outcomes are really good. So on the whole, it's a really kind of cheerful, upbeat specialty. And I don't know, to me, it's kind of seems important. I mean, everyone will argue that all doctors will argue that their specialty is the most important. But to me, it just seems the most important. And a lot of the time in adults, you know, the conditions you're dealing with are to some extent self-inflicted, whereas in paediatrics, it's never the case. Maybe the parents' fault, but very rarely the children's fault. So, yeah, I've always been interested in paediatrics. I think the pathology is really interesting as well.
Right.
And yeah, it's just kind of an important thing to do.
Yeah, true. You're one of the few people I think that's ever said to me, pathology being interesting. I can't relate to that.
Really?
In the slightest. No, I hate it. It's way too yeah, especially when you start looking down the microscope and looking at cellular level. No, that's
okay. I'm not really thinking about looking at cells at a cellular level. It's more, you know, the diseases that you see
and the diagnostics related to that.
Yeah, and it's just a big variety of conditions that you see in paediatrics. So yeah, I find it really interesting.
Well, that's pretty good though, that you get to do something that you enjoy as well though.
Yeah, sure. Most of the time anyway.
Yeah. And so segueing onto that, into your running, I think I mentioned to you briefly that, because I'm currently studying to be a vet, and I've found that since I've been studying, I understand my body better, and I've kind of been able to apply, you know, if you understand the body systems a little bit more, how everything functions, even though for me I'm not looking at humans, but you know veterinary species aren't too dissimilar, I think I've been able to apply that into what I'm doing. So I was sort of wondering what you learned at medical school in your medical training and within your profession as a doctor. Do you think that helps you as an athlete, and has that made you a better athlete and make you think about things more, or does it potentially hinder you because you understand it in a different way and realize the damage that you're doing over a long distance?
Yeah, I mean, I've never really thought about it that much, to be honest. I think and also because I've been a runner a shorter period of time than I've been a doctor, so it's not like prior to going to medical school I was training and had no idea what I was doing, I suppose. I think for anybody, having like a basic understanding of physiology is important when it comes to training and understanding why you're doing certain things. But at the same time, there are some people who will happily, you know, follow a training program or do what a coach tells them to do and actually don't really need to understand what they're doing. Mm. But yeah, certainly for me, and I imagine for you as well, you would like to understand and question the purpose of every session that you're doing.
Yeah.
In terms of what you're trying to achieve.
So you are one of those people that looks at a session and you say, why am I doing that? Or what's the purpose of that? And therefore, if you know the purpose, you know what, you know, you're going to get more out of it. You are a questioner. rather than just a blind follower.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, no, I'm exactly that's... the same.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my coach would agree with that.
Yeah. So potentially, actually, maybe aside from sort of a high level understanding of the physiology, you're not necessarily thinking, oh, well, everything I've learned, I can directly apply. It's more, I was a doctor, now I'm running, sure, I can use some, but it's not, I'm not thinking, yeah, it's giving me a massive advantage in this, or I'm really diving very deep into physiology and sporting performance. It's slightly on a maybe slightly higher level and using what you do know to your advantage. And
yeah, for sure. You don't certainly don't have to be a doctor or a vet to be a good athlete.
No, no. Think. No, but I was interested to hear though, because yeah, I think it's helped me, but then I spent a lot of time doing reading around a lot of other subjects. So I think maybe it gives you the basis, or it helps understand like at a base level. And then from that, you can build on to maybe understand things a little bit better if you wish. That's what I think anyway.
Yeah. And I think, and when people suggest you do things like try a new diet or try, I don't know, some sort of wacky recovery technique and like kind of understanding physiology often means that you can be like, no, that's a load of rubbish. Like that makes no sense at all.
Yeah. Disregard it offhand.
Exactly. Exactly.
And, were you going to take, this is through the grapevine really, but were you going to take a sabbatical was it for this season out of medicine for a bit?
Yeah, I was planning to take 6 months off from February to August this year, which I started.
and then went downhill.
Exactly. Within a few weeks, it became apparent that there would be no travelling or races for the foreseeable future. So I got in contact with my training program director and got a job back. So it didn't happen this year, but fingers crossed it will happen another time.
Yeah. So what was the plan that you thought we're going to go full time and see what a difference it can make?
Exactly. So because I've always worked, I've never been able to train like a full time athlete really. And it was just curiosity. I think if I never did it, then I would always be left wondering whether I could have been a better runner. And maybe, you know, it wouldn't have worked, and maybe I would have trained too much and got ill or injured, and then I'd know, and at least I'd be happy. And over a 6 month period, you know, it's not really a big deal, 6 months out of work. So it wasn't I'm going to try it and see how it goes and maybe extend it for longer. It was always just going to be 6 months. And then if it went well, I could perhaps repeat it at a later stage or something.
Sure. So if you're thinking of potentially taking this sabbatical for some other stage further down the line, do you think you'll keep a hand in anything, i.e., you know, to keep the grey cells working? Or are you just going to go like, all out, train, eat, sleep, or whatever, nothing else? Like, are you going to go kind of like all in on it, or keep a little bit of something on the side, whether that's medicine or something you're doing currently, or just something else to tick along beside it?
So there's certainly no way I would be able to deal with just training and eating and sleeping and doing nothing else, like on a long-term basis. But I really don't know whether I would get bored doing it for a short period of time or not, or whether I'd need to be doing something else. So the plan this year was, I was doing a bit of locum work early on, so I was still doing some work, and then I was going to go to the US for 90 days.
Right.
And then I'd be in a completely new environment and perhaps wouldn't have the opportunity to be thinking about medicine or work or anything. So I think that would have worked out okay. But yeah, I really have no idea. It's really interesting, to be honest.
Yeah. I think as well, from my experience, different people need different things. Like some people are quite, you know, okay going just right, all I'm doing is running or training or what have you. And then they don't want any other distraction. But then maybe other people require something that actually you think, you know, I think potentially a common misconception is if you want to be the best at something, you need to dedicate to it 100%. You can't think of it. But I think in those situations, if you all you have is one thing, if that one thing starts going bad, what then props you up? Or where do you get your kind of, you know, happiness from or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and
yeah, go on, sorry.
I totally agree. And I think if running is all you do, then that extra pressure that is inevitably there can impact performance and things. Mm. For me, and I imagine you as well, I think, yeah, knowing that it's not the most important thing in the world, and, you know, and the result of the race is obviously important, but, you know, if it all goes wrong, then it's really no big deal. And I think, yeah, not having that pressure can be really beneficial, and you can actually, you know, improve performance.
Yeah, no, definitely. It'd be interesting to see. Yeah, I'd be fascinating to see that when you do that, whenever that is, how you find being a full-time athlete. I mean, 6 months actually isn't very long, as you say, at all. So you probably, yeah, it'd be probably like just awesome for like 6 months. I guess it'd be like a bigger test if you were to like take a couple of years or something and see kind of the changes you could like make over that time. Because before I went to university, I raced on the bike actually. And I did that full time for 8 years. And oh, wow. So I've kind of seen or been in the position of doing something full time and then doing something alongside, you know, like a university in my case, but you know what it's like is quite intense. And I thought when I was on the bike, right, no, I can't have anything else because all it's going to be is distraction. And I know there were a couple of people around me that thought, no, you should definitely do something as a, you know, and I actually wish I listened at the time, because even though now I think the balance is perhaps potentially too far one way, i.e. it's like too much of work and not enough time to train, you know, but actually if you can find the correct medium, I think it's potentially a more powerful or kind of you can achieve more in like that harmony. But again, everyone's different. So it's certainly, I don't know, I find that different to see what works. I find it interesting to see what works for some people and what works for others.
I think you're probably right. And I think finding that perfect balance though is really, really tricky.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
As you said, you think for you at the moment, you know, perhaps your university stuff is taking up a bit too much time. But yeah, it's tricky finding that perfect balance. But in theory, I think you're absolutely right.
When do you think you might sort of take the dive again? Next season, all being well, or with races, or?
Hopefully next season. But if come February, the future is not looking particularly bright.
Then I'll delay a little bit longer.
Exactly. There's no point, you know, training, doing it unless I'm, you know, almost 100% sure that the races I want to do are actually gonna happen.
Yeah, no, for sure. You might as well do it properly. So we sort of discussed a little, you know, very, very briefly discussed your medical training and perhaps how that helps you understand your body better, or maybe not so well. depending which way you look at it, oh shit, I'm damaging my body. But I think I mentioned to you before the pod, that quite a popular topic at the moment is sort of how women can maximize performance and well-being around their menstrual cycle. And again, perhaps being a doctor helps you understand this further. I'm certainly not an expert. You know, the veterinary sort of species estrous cycle is similar, but not exactly the same. But I know you mentioned to me that you don't modify your training around this, and I guess it's everyone is different and it affects individuals in different ways. So do you find this isn't something that all holds you back in any way? And I don't know, I was thinking, to you, is the sort of advice that you would give out to female runners, given potentially it doesn't affect you, would you say, you know, sort of crack on, or, you know, what would you say, or how would you go about that?
Yeah, so it's an interesting topic. And as a paediatrician, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert in it. No. And, you know, I'm not an endocrinologist or anything. But for people who perhaps don't know a whole lot about, you know, the menstrual cycle and how it can potentially affect women, I think that essentially in the latter, in sort of the second 2 weeks of the menstrual cycle, so the 2 weeks before your period, often women find that their heart rate's a little bit higher, they're perhaps less good at using their fat stores, so they're a bit more reliant on sort of exogenous carbohydrate to train, and just aren't able to train as well. Mm. And I think we've always kind of known that, you know, you just get in a bad mood before your period starts, but I don't think people have until relatively recently actually thought about the impact on training. So I think that certainly some people find it hard to nail their sessions sort of in those few days before they start their period and things. So there's a lot of thought that you should perhaps be training more on effort rather than running at a specific pace and things, because mm-hmm. sessions are just going to be a bit harder. And if you're going to race in that sort of period, you know, it could potentially impact performance. But I don't think we really know whether we should be avoiding doing hard sessions at certain times of the month and whether we still get the same adaptation. I certainly don't know. I don't know if, you know, anyone knows, to be honest. But this is for women who have like a natural cycle.
Yeah.
So people who aren't using hormonal contraception. For me, like, I honestly can't say I've noticed that much. I think, yeah, it certainly affects women more, some more than others, for whatever reason. I think because there are so many other factors that affect how you feel, you know, like how hard you're training, your sleep, like for people like me who work shifts, there's no sort of, I don't really have much of a routine. There's, you know, life stress, work stress, there's so many things, so many variables. I find it really hard to pick apart, like, if I'm having a bad day, is that because of the time of the month, or is it for one of those other million things that it could be?
That's a very good point, actually.
So yeah, I think it's important to have an awareness and be thinking, you know, and not beat yourself up if you have a bad session at a certain time in the month. I think women are very, you know, certainly for me, you know, I tend to get in a mood if a session doesn't go particularly well. But yeah, having that awareness and not beating yourself up if you have a bad session in the build up to your period, or, you know, if you're just craving like sugary foods and things like that, it's you know, it's probably because of your hormones. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot that I need to learn about it as well. And yeah, I think it's just really important that coaches and female athletes are thinking about it a bit more and talking about it a bit more, I guess.
Yeah, and no, that's actually really very interesting also for me. It's educational on a number of levels. But they're talking about coaches on that. So if you're not necessarily adjusting much around this, I assume that's not something you discuss with your coach, which is Martin Cox, right? Yeah. Or do you?
Yeah, it's certainly, we have discussed it in the past, and I know that with some of the other female athletes he coaches, it does have a more of an impact. And yeah, he's certainly very open to to it, as are most coaches, I think, these days. But I think it would be a bit different if I was a track runner when you're doing hard sessions and constantly trying to hit splits and things like that. But because I do all my training on sort of effort anyway, it doesn't really, you know, I don't dwell on, I try not to dwell too much if sessions don't go well from time to time. And yeah, it's not, as I said, my training plan doesn't revolve around my menstrual cycle.
No. Awareness without letting it dictate everything is that kind of sort of brief overview. And I mean, maybe as you understand it more and others understand it more, and perhaps there are performance gains to be made, whether it's nutritional or, you know, making sure you're doing your sessions at the right time. Maybe you will be able to make, you know, little improvements here and there, and that leads to a 1% performance, and that could be the difference between third and first. I don't know, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, there is lots of evidence to suggest that, you know, you're going to be performing best probably in, you know, the first, well, probably weeks two or three of your cycle. But practically, how it's possible to to just race in those weeks is very tricky, isn't it?
No, definitely, for sure. Thanks for that. It's interesting, very interesting.
But yeah, it's really reading subjects.
Yeah, no, very good. Going back onto coaching and Martin, how long have you been working with Martin, your coach?
I think it's coming up to 3 years, I think, if I haven't got that completely wrong.
Okay, because I'm quite interested as well in coaching and things, and to get your take on, because your performances are improving over the years. You are getting better results, and whether that's a result of doing it longer, or it's Martin's contribution, or probably a combination of both. So what do you think makes a good coach, and what do you look for in a coach, would you say? Like, what does Martin do well, or just generally speaking, we don't have to pick on Martin. but, you know, is it the sort of the soft skills, or is it you're looking for something that's, like, you know, really sort of someone that's very analytical and technical based, or, you know, what do you think makes a really, really good coach?
Yeah, so it's not like I've worked with lots of different coaches, so I don't have a whole lot to go on here, but I think that
Well, what would you want? Would you want in a coach, or what do you like in a coach, perhaps, then?
I think the way that Martin and I work together is really good for lots of reasons. I think we have quite a close relationship, we have quite a lot of contact, which maybe some people need and some people don't need or don't want. But for me, I find it really, really helpful. And knowing that he really cares, like he has a lot of sort of personal investment in like all his
wants it as much as you want it, sort of thing.
Exactly. Everyone he coaches, he has, he's invested in. Whether they're results or whatever, he's just really passionate about it, and that really, really shows. And so when I'm training or racing, I'm doing it for myself, but knowing that he's invested in it as well, like it's another person who you kind of feel accountable to.
That's what I think sometimes, maybe someone that needs a bit of motivation or needs pushing out the door, if they have the coach that's looking over it, set the session again, it might be like, oh, I better do it because, you know, my coach will look at it and it's not exactly wrong, sort of thing. Yeah,
it's knowing that, you know, he's put a lot of time and effort into deciding that this is the best session to do. And it's kind of disrespectful to not do it if you feeling lazy or it's raining or whatever. I mean, most of the time I don't need that to motivate myself to get out of the door, but on, you know, when you're tired and it's dark and cold and you needed that extra reason to get the session done, then it's there.
No, definitely. And you just jumping back, you say that you train off effort. Before you started working with Martin, was that the same, or was that something? And by effort, do you mean perceived exertion, or is that off a quantifiable measurement like heart rate or something?
Yeah, just a perceived exertion. Yeah, I've never really used heart rate for training. I used to be a lightweight rower actually at university, and back then I used to train off heart rate. But since I've been running, I've never used heart rate.
How come? Out of interest.
How come I don't use heart rate?
Yeah. So how do you? So if you're going into a session or just a run, so if Martin say sets, I don't know, an hour or something. Say like you're going out for an hour, just aerobic sort of threshold run or something. And what's he saying to set that? Are you kind of like, oh, you're going out for, what's your perceived exertion? Like, how's your effort? How are you measuring that? Or literally it's just like, I'm going to run so I feel like okay. And then it's like, I know my body so that when I'm doing, say, threshold intervals, I kind of, you've got enough experience that you know what that feels like. Is that how you kind of do it? Or because I work very sort of like numbers based. So to think like, oh, I'm literally just going off feel, I'm like, oh my God.
You broke up a little bit there, so I missed the very beginning, but if without giving a specific session as an example, I just know what it feels like. Like I know, and if I'm starting a race, I know what it feels like to run at 100 mile pace. I know what's sustainable. I don't know how better to explain it, but I think
I'm just wondering how it comes back to analyzing that, because if you can't quantify, if you're not quantifiably measuring anything, how do you therefore necessarily measure improvement over time? Is that literally just going on feel as well, or do you just say do like a flat time trial of a set distance?
I don't think you necessarily have to measure improvement over time. I think results probably speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. I think I know if I'm fit because I know, like, if I go for a 3-hour moderate pace run or a 6-hour run in the mountains, I just know whether I'm fit or not.
Yeah.
I can just feel it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you know when you're on good form and you know when you're maybe not on good form. No, it's interesting, like, because that's just, it's a very, very different, it's also the other end of where I work from. I kind of go all off numbers. So to someone like you that kind of does the opposite, but then it's achieving what you're achieving, I'm like, ah, man, maybe I don't need to be spending so much time like crunching the data.
But I think it, for the type of running that I do, it's like running 100 miles in the mountains, there are so many variables. The numbers don't really matter. Like the pace doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. And if I, could improve my 10K time by 20 seconds or something, that doesn't mean anything when it comes to 100 mile races.
No, I
think that's part of it. And certainly if I was a track runner or a marathon runner or something, perhaps data would be more important.
Yeah.
But I just don't think it's that relevant when it comes to ultra running.
No, yeah, that's probably a good point. Although not a marathon runner, but you did do Seville this year, didn't you? Earlier in the year?
Yeah.
What was it? You did it 2:40 something, wasn't it? It's a decent turnout.
It was all right. It doesn't make me a marathon runner though, just because I ran a marathon.
What was the thought process behind that? Just to see what you could do, or
I guess if you spend all year running 100 mile races, you get kind of slow. And I think so I did kind of a period of marathon training over the winter. Just to sort of improve running economy and get a bit faster in view of doing a faster 50-mile race in April.
Right.
So it was kind of, the marathon wasn't important. It was just going through the process of doing that training.
Sure.
And if you're going to do some marathon training, you may as well do a marathon.
So are you... sorry, go on.
I think I finished. So, but as I said, the time wasn't in any way important. It was just about going through the process of running a bit faster.
Sure. So are you someone that kind of feels that maybe, like, for example, Seville Marathon was more of a tune-up and something to come at the back end of potentially maybe a faster block of training to get you ready for a 50. Do you use races within your training then as sort of little sort of micro goals along the way rather than someone that's just trained and then just hits a massive peak? Is that something you like to do?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I like racing. I love racing. Sometimes I will do races purely as long training runs. I did a few of them last year where you just train right through it. You don't taper for it or anything. And that's sometimes a nice way to do things, an easy way to do things. I think all runners, we want to train. And yeah, we just want to race as much as possible. And it's not always practical to, to be sort of to peak.
Yeah,
like you can't peak
top.
Like 10 times a year or something.
No. Well, there's one way of doing that, but we won't go there.
sometimes it will be, like the Seville Marathon. I mean, I did kind of take it seriously. Like I did taper for it and stuff. But it wasn't, it wasn't a goal for the year or anything. And then there'll be some races that I'll just use as training races and just as a long run basically. And then there'll be like a couple of big races a year where I'll try and peak for them.
Yeah. And in 2019, because I was looking back through some of your results and saying that it's difficult to be in top shape throughout the year, but correct me again if I'm wrong, and there were a few other things in there, but so you won the Highland Fling in April, is that correct, last year? And then you're fourth at Western States in June, fifth at UTMB in August, and then you won the Ultra Trail Cape Town 100K in November. Now, like Western States 100 miles, like UTMB 106, Cape Town 100K, like the Flings is like over 50 miles. Like to me, that's like, whoa, that's a lot of like long races. And that's between like April and November, which on paper, that's like a long time. But I imagine the fallout from a 100-mile race in the mountains is massive. So like how are you going about recovering from, so if we remove the Fling from it and just go like Western States, like a big dog race, how are you going from getting fourth at Western States at the end of June to then recovering, re-getting into like top shape again for UTMB in August? Because that's not really that long.
No, it's not that long. And yeah, a lot of people would say they're too close together, and because they're very different races, yeah, it's not ideal. And I could almost say that perhaps like UTMB wasn't great last year, and perhaps that was because I wasn't quite ready for it after Western States. But yeah, I think in the build up to Western States, I was doing very specific training, kind of lots of fast runnable trails, and wasn't really getting that much vert in. And then, yeah, a couple of weeks after Western States, I was sort of back in the mountains trying to get lots of hiking in, get the vert in. So I guess I probably had about a six-week period of specific training for UTMB before tapering again. And yeah, like I didn't have the best race in the world at UTMB last year, and maybe that was because I wasn't ready, or maybe it was something completely different. Who knows?
You never know. But what was I going to say? I was just going to pick up on something you said that was quite interesting. So if you've managed the time to get in a six week block post Western States, you clearly your recovery time from Western States isn't that long. Like, is there anything? Are you just one of those people that sort of does 100 mile and then 3 days later is walking normally, which is really irritating for everyone else involved? Or are you doing anything like special or a little bit out the box with regard to your recovery? Or is it literally just like good diet, making sure you're sleeping?
Yeah, nothing special at all.
So you are just really irritating in that way then.
I'll say that my sleep is terrible pretty much all year round. So
right.
It's certainly not that. I think Western States, I was pretty broken actually afterwards. I couldn't walk. Most of the time I can walk normally the next day after the race, but it did take 2 or 3 days to be able to walk downhill again. Like, you know, walk downstairs, one leg on each step. Yeah. That was a struggle.
I do that after like a marathon. So, I mean, I don't think if 100 miles, no way. I wouldn't be getting downstairs the next day. So you must be thinking about that. You must be quite robust, like biomechanically, if you're usually able to, you know, get down the stairs normally or what have you. So are you gymming? Do you hit the gym and do like stuff like that in order to kind of reduce your injury risk and make you more robust?
I do some strength and conditioning. I mean, most of the stuff I can do at home, obviously people are going to the gym actually at the moment, but yeah. In recent months, no one's been going to the gym. So I do a little bit. I'm not doing like lifting heavy weights and doing squats and things, but I do a bit of sort of body weight exercises and some sort of squats with dumbbells and things like that, step ups and that type of thing. But I don't know how much of the fact that, you know, I can run 100 miles and not be completely broken, or that I haven't, touch wood, had any serious injuries. I don't know how much of it is because of the strength and conditioning, or whether it's just the, you know, the type of training that I'm doing. I really don't know, but I'm not gonna stop doing strength and conditioning because it's not a risk I'm prepared to take. But yeah, I really don't know what's helping, to be honest.
Okay, and also you said that you jumped into the mountains for a couple of weeks, do some power hiking. By the mountains, like where are you going? Like where in, you're talking like the British mountains or like the proper Alpine?
Both.
So you're able to take the time to go and you sort of be able to take the time off and go and do that, and you sort of fix your work around it a little bit. You're able to sort of manage that.
Yeah, I mean, when I said 2 weeks in the mountains, I was kind of meaning weekends and things, I guess.
Oh right, okay.
So, like when I'm in the UK, I'll try and get up to either the lakes or Snowdonia and get some long days in. And the last couple of years, actually, I've been out to the Alps just for a few days, about a month before UTMB, and I've done a lap of Mont Blanc as a training run over a few days. And that's really helpful.
So do you think because I don't know, like training specificities probably is very important, isn't it, a lot of the time, and you're in the Peak District, so
kind
roughly,
of
sort
close.
Of that
yeah.
that way
yeah
there's quite a big difference between the topography there and what you're going to get in the Alps. If you were to, well, one, it's like, you know, more impressive to do well when, you know, you're training on hills and then racing in the mountains. But if you were to take your sabbatical, going back to that, would you debate going sort of all in and like thinking, right, I'll go and live in the mountains and see what a difference that makes as well, just from a conditioning point of view, or not?
Maybe. I think the way that it was going to work was that actually I'd be back at work before UTMB, just the way that jobs work. So I wasn't going to be able to go out to the Alps for a long period of time. But yeah, I think, I don't know, you would think that it would make a huge difference sort of living in the Alps. But maybe actually you'd risk doing too much, and it'd be so tempting just to, you know, do a 1,000 meter climb on every run that you went on.
Yeah.
And it would seem a shame, you know, shame not to in many ways. Yeah. But maybe, you know, just going to Snowdonia once a week or something is all you need to do. I think the biggest thing that I would benefit from is being at altitude. I'm not very good at dealing with altitude. So I think for me, that's the biggest hindrance of being in the UK. It's not physically the getting the vert in. It's being at sea level.
Have you thought about doing simulated altitude training then, or not? Again, is that something you might consider?
It doesn't. Well, do you mean like altitude tents and things?
Either from like a sleep system where you're sleeping high in a tent and training at sea level. But I guess I don't know. Again, I'm not an altitude training expert by any stretch of the imagination. But perhaps if the issue is racing at altitude, maybe more of a benefit would be spending some sessions like here in the UK at simulated altitude to start conditioning the body. Would that make more of a difference, just to start tuning your body in rather than going for like the sleep system, because that actually you're not then exercising, you literally just, you know, increasing
volume. The benefits from sleep systems and using altitude chambers are very, very minimal. And I think, you know, with altitude tents and things, you have to be spending so much time in them for such a long period of time to get any benefits. It's probably not worth it. And so the last couple of years, I've been able to go out to the Alps a couple of weeks before UTMB, which I think would be more beneficial than anything else than trying to do anything in the UK, to be honest.
Yeah.
That's kind of my take on it.
Before we move on to the Bob, which I think most people are probably wanting to hear about as well, I just had to ask you about the Cape Wrath trail that you did a couple of years ago. Like, what on earth kind of brought you to do that? You did it in the winter as well, didn't you? Like, what was the sort of thought process behind that? And I mean, what, you probably 5 hours of daylight a day or something, or like, you know, it seems utter madness to me. Like, why did you think, let's go for a Cape Wrath, the fastest known time in the winter?
So the main reason, so it wasn't my idea, I'll put that out there.
Okay, so you just followed along and thought, sod it, let's go for it.
I obviously agreed to do it. It was, I can't remember if it was either Matt or Ellie's idea. So right. Matt and Ellie of Summit Fever Media, who made the film about it, they thought, what would be really cool to film? How about the Cape Wrath Trail? And Damien and I were kind of busy in the summer with races, and we didn't want to have to not race because of it. But the winter was kind of free, so it seemed like a good idea to do it in the winter. And it made it. Yeah, it's just an extra challenge, really. So, you know, I would love to do it in the summer, don't get me wrong. I would love to go and do it again and see all the bits that that we didn't see because it was dark, which was a majority of it. So that was basically the reason behind it. It was more because we had nothing else going on in the winter, but the summer we were tied up with races and things.
And it's just a sort of heck of an adventure by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
So those sort of that are listening, I had to look this up. And so you did it in, again, correct me if I'm wrong, 4 days, 9 hours and 43 minutes. You're measuring things in days, which is crazy for starters. I imagine you stopped at Bothy's, and I mean, how much did you sleep in that time? I just thought, my mind boggles when you're looking at that.
We stopped and slept in Bothy's, and sometimes we just stopped on the trail. When you just become so overwhelmingly tired, you just can't keep your eyes open. Often we would just drop to the floor. We wouldn't even take our packs off, and we'd just close our eyes for a couple of minutes and have a micro sleep, and then carry on. And when we came across Bothy's, we might, have a couple of hours or something here and there. But certainly wasn't a lot of sleep. And I think being dark all the time, it made dealing with the sleep deprivation much harder. It was very predictable at kind of 4 o'clock, as soon as it got dark, that I would just be like, this is tough, I need to sleep. So that was a big challenge.
How do you battle that? So when the body, because I've never been in a situation where, like, I haven't done anything as long as you've done. So I've never been in a situation where I feel, like I want to sleep. Like, how do you push through that and keep the body moving? Do you have something going through your head? Do you start talking to yourself, or how do you manage that?
With difficulty, certainly it helps having someone with you. So we could talk. Sometimes I would like play games with my poles. I'd be like tapping them together and trying to do something to distract myself.
Oh my God.
I've had it in the spine race as well. I remember I was started singing to myself a few times, just as something to try and fight that need to sleep. Sometimes you can't fight it and you just need to close your eyes and have a couple of minutes.
Brutal, yeah. No respect. I don't think I'll ever do anything that nuts. Let's get on to your recent Bob Graham round. So you just set the women's record for it, which was fourth fastest time ever. So your time, 14 hours 34:26, which I think I put in a message to you as like a sort of hell of a shift. Was that's seriously moving? So what? So Killian's 12:52, so he smashed it, didn't he? And then Billy Bland 13:53. And then you were just behind Rob Jebb, 14:30, and you knocked 50 minutes off Jasmine Paris's record. So that's a huge margin to take down and knocking on the door, sort of getting on the podium of the guys, which is pretty impressive. Very impressive. I imagine most people know what the round is, but 42 peaks in the lake, 74 miles, and starts and finishes in Keswick at the Moot Hall. And it's broken down to 5 legs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So when did you decide you were going to have a crack at a record-breaking round? When did that come about?
It was back in March when I realised that I wasn't going to the US or racing. it was the obvious thing to do. I mean, I've always wanted to do a Bob Graham, and I've always known I'll do it at some point, but I'd always imagined I was running for the second fastest time. I didn't think Jasmine's record was within reach at all. With no races, I had no excuse. I just had to there wasn't any other record that was prestigious or meaningful enough to me, I suppose. So yeah, there wasn't any thinking involved. It was the obvious thing to do. I admit that during the lockdown months, my enthusiasm did dwindle a bit. When you're, as with everyone, I was confined to just doing chasing vert by doing loops of my local wood. And yeah, it was hard. But as soon as we could get back in the fells again, sort of beginning of June, I put a lot of time and effort into getting on the course. And yeah, it was only really in the final few weeks when I started to do some of the legs at record pace that I thought, oh, maybe the record is possible.
Right. Did you go up to the lakes, start moving in the hills again, did you get around the whole course, I assume, over time?
Yeah. Some of the legs
I've
done.
And went back and started running at the pace you wanted to run.
Yeah, exactly. So when I was happy with the nab and I'd done all the legs quite a few times, I did all the legs, a maximum of two consecutively at record pace, or just under. And it felt fast, but it didn't feel completely insane. And that was running with a pack, normally in terrible conditions.
Yeah.
So it was after those runs, I thought, you know, maybe it just possible, but I still think I'll have to have the run of my life to actually break the record.
Okay. And because you know, most of the time now you're racing on the trails, and Euro trails are a lot different to the fells. So apart from nipping up and jumping on them at the weekend or what have you, was there anything you changed within your training to prepare for the fells as opposed to the trails? Or do you just think about, right, as long as I've got the engine, I've got the engine?
No, not really. I did spend an awful lot of time on the course, and I did feel like, I remember I did a leg of the Bob back in March, just before lockdown. And I remember feeling like such an amateur. Like, I was so bad at running downhill. This was like at the end of my marathon training block. It's amazing how you de-skill at sort of your technical skills. But having spent a good, you know, I can't remember exactly how many, you know, 8 or 9 weeks being in the fells once a week, doing really long runs on the course, I just felt like a completely different runner. I thought, yeah. I felt like, you know, my technical skills just improved so much by just being on the fells.
And do you think so you clearly had quite singular focus from March, and then you delivered a heck of a result. Do you think you'll kind of use that approach, you know, when you actually get back into races and be like, heck, you know, look how good I can be if I just like pick out like one event to really nail?
I think you're right in that having a long period of time with no races really, really helped. And I think that's why, I mean, it's partly why so many other records have been broken this summer. It's partly because we haven't got anything else to do, but partly because we've all had really long training blocks and really consistent training. So normally, like in a, you know, 4 or 5 month period, you'll be training, then tapering, then racing, then resting, and you go through that cycle, you know, maybe a few times. But because we haven't had that, I think you just get a bit fitter. So I think that's probably why I was able to run that time.
And would you attribute it at all to your paces? Because I mean, I don't really know the Bob that well, but whenever I followed it, paces seemed quite key to putting in a really fast round. So who did you have supporting you, and do you think they contributed, you know, significantly or slightly? You know, if you've sort of fallen out with any paces, feel free to say that they sort of in fact hindered you on the descent, you know, but
no,
you know, who was out on the course with you?
There are too many to name. That I had 10 people.
Okay.
And as well as road support and someone on Broad Stand, well, a couple of people on Broad Stand, which is the rock climb.
Right.
Absolutely, it's the most important thing. There's no way I could have run that fast
because they were pacing it, or because you was because you didn't have to think about where you were going. Like, what's the biggest like help of having the pacers with you?
The biggest help is they carry your food and drink.
Right.
I think that makes the biggest difference of anything. And yeah, I think as I'd done all the legs in training, always carrying a pack, you really don't appreciate how much of a difference it makes if you don't have to carry that extra weight. Yeah. So I think that's the biggest difference that the pacers make.
It's a bit like, and on the also, bike, we used to say, like, the difference between like a training set of wheels and a race set of wheels. It's like you get off your training set and you're on your race set and you're like, whoa, absolutely fly. Same with like not carrying the fuel. But
yeah, I think so. And then with navigation as well, I think, so I did know the route well, but certainly I had some local guys who knew a few little secret lines, which helped. I think, you know, that helped maybe shave a few minutes off. But also, I think when you're trying to run fast on difficult terrain, it's just easier to follow. I think if so what I found in training when I was trying to run the legs fast is I kept making silly navigation errors because I was trying to run fast. I was looking at the ground, at the terrain, and would just make silly mistakes. So I think you just run a bit faster if you're following someone, regardless if they're taking you on a different route or something. I think it's just, it's just being a follower is just a bit faster.
Mm-hmm. And what's stage sort of during the round do you think, I've got this, I've basically smashed this record? Was it sort of halfway, or were you just not until you kind of on the home stretch into Keswick and you're like, I've nailed it?
It wasn't really, I'd probably say the end of leg four.
Right.
I thought it was going to happen. I think prior to that, I was fully expecting my to blow up and have to stop or something. It just seemed a bit too good to be true, because I knew that I shouldn't be running that fast. I wasn't expecting to run that fast.
Okay.
So I was convinced I'd gone off too hard, and I was the whole way through, I was enjoying myself, but thinking, when's the bomb coming? Exactly. And then it didn't.
It didn't happen. So if it didn't happen, that, well, again, it could be a variety of reasons, or you're just in really, really good shape, but you must have also probably nailed, because it's, 14 and a half hours is a long time to be moving pretty quickly for. So you must have nailed your nutrition, probably. Like, what are you, because it's a long time, but you're going fast, like, what are you consuming? Again, I've never gone for that long, so I wouldn't know.
So I'm pretty good at eating, and I think it does make a massive difference. So I just ate gels
for 14 much. Hours, just gels.
Yeah.
So, wow. How's your stomach not wrecked?
Oh, my stomach was fine.
How many gels are you consuming?
Quite a few. I haven't counted them.
Fair play.
So the gels I use, they're not your average maltodextrin based gels. They are the brand is called Spring Energy.
Right.
And they contain more complex carbohydrates. So they're a bit like baby food, to be honest. So they are maybe like some pureed rice with fruit and that type of thing. A vast majority of my calories came from them. I did drink some mountain fuel as well.
Like standard what, electrolyte carbohydrate mix, is that? Or
And I had a glass of Coke at all the road crossings, and that was pretty much it.
Whoa, man, these Spring Energy gels must be the thing, because I can't imagine like consuming gels for 14 and a half hours.
They are awesome. And I have to say that even before I started using them, when I used to use other types of energy gel, even if I was, really on it and I was taking three or four an hour for however long the race was, I would still get kind of peaks and troughs in energy levels. But with the spring ones, I don't get that. My energy levels are fairly constant, and I attribute that to having the complex carbohydrate rather than just pure sugar.
Definitely. Do you use them in training then as well, in order to, obviously they're not the just, you know, sugar based gel, but do you have to condition your stomach in order to take that? Or
personally, not? I don't use them in training, but because I've if I say this, it'll jinx the next time I do a race, but I feel like I've kind of nailed my nutrition, my race nutrition, and I've had the same strategy for the last, I don't know, couple of years in all my races, and I've done the same thing, and now I just know it works. So yeah. I don't need to train. It feels a little bit, what's the word? Not gluttonous, but it just seems a bit it seems a bit wasteful and a bit unnecessary to train with that, you know, that quantity of gels.
Yeah. No, that's in order to, you know, to quote you, nailed your nutrition. I'm gonna hold you to that. You know, if you have a race where you bonk, I'm gonna be like, thought you nailed nutrition. Is that come through like just time and just trial and error and just seeing what works and then, yeah, just honing it down over time?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, as I said, I mean, I've always been good at eating. Like, I've never been in a race and not been able to eat because I feel sick or something. But as I said, I found that with other energy gels, my energy levels just weren't as good. And during long races, I struggled to eat solid food. I think when you're working pretty hard, it's just so I need something that I can just swallow without, that stays in my mouth for as little time as possible. So it, for me, it has to be pureed liquidy something. I came across the spring gels and was immediately really interested and started using them, and I haven't looked back.
They do sound great, actually. Might have to see what they're all about. No, that's great, and congratulations again on the record. That's really, really impressive. And just sort of to round up, because I know I've taken a lot of your time now. What are your plans for sort of the rest of the year? And obviously, we talked a little bit about if races start happening again in 2021, what might you do? So what's on your calendar? If anything,
if races happen this year, then I will be there. I have a couple of races in mind, if both of them get cancelled, that would not be in any way a surprise. So I think it's I'm not kind of, they're there, but I'm not training specifically for them at the moment because it's a bit risky and I'm highly likely to be disappointed. Sure. I might get in another kind of fell run challenge.
Okay. Fastest time thing. Sort of job. And we'll see what that materializes as. And next year, I mean, assuming all kind of is back to normal next summer, what are you, are you targeting? Are you going to go back to the States or?
Yeah, I'd like to do States and UTMB if I can. It's a bit boring because I've done them before, but they are just the races that excite me the most, I guess. Absolutely. I want to do both of those again. I'm not bored yet.
Great. We'll see what happens. Fingers crossed. Because I think everyone wants some racing back.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, great. Well, thanks very much for giving me so much of your time again. That's really interesting. Enjoyed all the educational chat earlier on as well. I've got some reading up to do.
I think I do as well, to be honest.
Yeah. It's one of those sort of subjects you could talk sort of forever on, really, isn't it? And also training, like, it's fascinating, and everyone's different and everyone does things differently, and I find it interesting to hear what you do and what Martin does and how different it is to me and how different it is to other people I know. And it just shows sort of everyone's different, aren't they, and everyone achieves their best self or goes about it in varying different ways. So that's what makes sport great, I think, actually. So we're all kind of aiming for the same thing, but go about it in all different ways.
Exactly, because all, you know, our physiology is all different. So, yeah. Cool. No. Well, thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
Well, no,
your podcast.
I don't think it kind of is now. No. Maybe I'll sort of like usurp it and change the name. And anyway, that's brilliant. Thanks so much, Beth, and all the best when you're back at work on your night shifts and all that jazz.
Cool. Well, yeah. Thanks a lot.